Now, we did say that we would have opportunity for clarifying questions at this stage. If anyone has any questions that they would like to put to Bishop Michael, to ask him to go over anything again that he's just said in his main presentation, now is your moment. Yes, we have a question here. George, you've got a microphone, I hope. You haven't. Ian, where is Ian? Fetch this man a microphone. Who is it here? It was Tom down here. Mm.
Thank you. Just on the piece at the end there, where you were talking about other religions coming to Christ. I'm sorry, I can't remember the reference, but I think it's in Acts where effectively messengers are sent out to the church. Is it at Antioch? Because there are a lot of Gentiles in the church at Antioch.
Yeah.
And obviously they are not following Jewish culture.
Yeah.
They are following, you know, their culture.
Mm.
And eventually it's sort of boiled down to four things, I think, which is... one is to do with blood, isn't it? One is to do with...
Yeah.
Sorry, I can't remember the four things.
Yeah.
But perhaps you could sort of refresh us on what it is I'm actually on about.
Is that, that's it, isn't it? Yes. Right. Shall I answer it?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think the question is, what is culture and what is religion? And that's not always easy to separate. I mean, I have close friends, Vyan Mastra, for instance, who's a pastor, admittedly a Presbyterian pastor, but we'll forgive him that for the time being, who has, in Indonesia, in Bali, who has developed a way of being Christian in Hindu Bali that draws on a great deal of the culture in terms of patterns of worship, speech, and so on. And there is nothing in that that I can fault. And Vyan is himself a great critic of his own work. But it would be different, just to continue with that example, if Vyan started to encourage people to go to the Hindu temple as part of what he was doing. Similarly with Islam, I mean, in Pakistan when I was ministering there, I mean, you have a few westernized churches in the big cities, but generally in villages and so on, and my diocese was a very villagey one, people would sit on the floor for worship. The person taking the service would take off his shoes. I mean, it's unthinkable to lead Christian worship with your shoes on in those places. And all that kind of thing, and that's perfectly fine. I mean, you know, that is what the culture expects in terms of reverence and so forth during worship. But there were, I mean, I knew some missionaries then who were working in that area who encouraged people who had committed their lives to Christ to continue going to the mosque for prayers. And they themselves tried to do it. Now, I would not do that because I think you would have to say things in the mosque that would be contrary to the Christian faith, the faith that I would want them to grow in. And also, there is this question about deceiving people. I mean, if you are a follower of Christ but pretend you are a Muslim, to what extent are you deceiving Muslims about who you are, and what happens when you're found out, which must happen, you know, eventually. So I would say yes to inculturation, to taking culture seriously, even the religious vocabulary of that culture, but no to continuing to encourage people in continuing in the cultic and the worship aspects of their previous religious life.
Thank you. So any other questions of clarification? There's one over here. As well, the microphone's moving that way. I'm glad you were kind to Presbyterians. The last two clergy who've left this parish have become Presbyterians.
Well, I know one of them, yes.
Janet, we had the question here.
Yeah, I'm not sure if this... you may already have touched on it on your previous answer, but when you spoke, you just made a comment, and I didn't quite understand the significance of it. You said something about Western missionaries didn't appreciate the effect they had on culture
or something like that when you were speaking about culture.
Could you explain that for me?
Yes, certainly. That was a reference to Professor Lamin Sane, who is himself a convert from Islam, is now a professor at Yale. His work has been on Bible translation. And the first point that he makes about Bible translation is that the Christian faith is by its very nature a translatable faith, because Jesus spoke in Aramaic but the New Testament was written in Greek. So the account of the gospel of Jesus was already, the first account of it was a translation, and that has always been the case. This he opposes to Islam, of course, where although Islam is a worldwide faith like Christianity, there is always a kind of Arabicness about Islam in the call to prayer, in the ritual prayer itself, in the nature of the Quran, and so forth. Now, what Lamin Sane was saying about the translation of the Bible, therefore, throughout the ages, but particularly for him in the African context, was that the missionaries who translated the Bible into one African language or another did not know at that time what huge impact the Bible would have on the cultures where they were doing the translation. So, in a place like Nigeria, the way in which the Bible is read and interpreted and lived, the 19th century CMS missionaries would have had no idea that it would, this would be the result. I suppose the one thing we can say to Lamin is, but that happens everywhere. Wherever the Bible is translated, you can never foretell the consequences.
Thank you. There was a hand over here.
Could you just say a little bit more about the rather intriguing prospect that it will be possible to argue that the logic of Islam would lead to Christ?
Yes, I thought somebody would catch on to this one. Let's put it personally. I have... many Muslim relatives who are devout Muslims, and I pray that they may come to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ. Of course I do. But if they are to do that, it must be to some extent a development out of what they believe about God, for instance. And that is the way I talk to them and to others. At one time I was regularly invited to a Muslim hospital at Christmas time to talk to them about Christmas. And I think it was a bit of an excuse for a party, to be quite honest. But anyway, I went, and I always began with the accounts of the birth of Jesus in the Quran, because they are so like the accounts of his birth in the New Testament. So I began with what people would know. And then I went on to talk about his titles in the Quran, and some of them are quite remarkable. I mentioned the Messiah, which he's regularly called. Why is he, what does that mean? What does Messiah mean? He is regularly called Jesus the Son of Mary. Why Son of Mary? That's almost a violence to the Arabic language, where people are known by the name of their father, not their mother. So why the mother? He is called the Word of God and Spirit from God. What does that mean? In some places it is said that the Jews said they had crucified him, but they did not. In other places, his death is mentioned on his own lips. Jesus prophesies his death. And I can actually show you verses in the Quran that speak not only of his death, not only of his birth and his death, but also his resurrection and his glorification. So I can see what Kenneth is getting at. I wouldn't just use the logic of Islam. I would somehow want to bring that logic, if such there is, into a relationship with what the Gospels are saying about Jesus. And it's very possible to do that.
Thank you. Let's take another one, if there's another question of clarification. One more here. Yes, thank you, George.
I can't remember exactly the words, but you mentioned something about a Sufi person who become a Christian in interpreting the Gospel of John. Do you see in Islam and these other religions some kind of valid experience of God spiritually?
Well, the Bible teaches that God has not left himself without witness anywhere. And so in creation and in conscience there is always a witness to God, however much obscured it is by error and sinfulness and all of those things. The task of the evangelist is often to relate whatever there is to the truth of to the full light of the gospel, which of course also requires the error and the sinfulness to be addressed. I think the other question is about to what extent people are prepared for Christ in another religious tradition. In some cases they are, in the sense that whilst they are fulfilling their rituals or saying their prayers, their need is not met. So the need is created by the ritual and the prayers, but it's not met by them, and so they have to look for something else, and that is Christ. That happens quite often. In some cases, people are led to fuller truth by partial truth. I mean, this is particularly true of Muslims, where what the Quran may say about Jesus, for example, the miracles of Jesus in the Quran have to do with healing the sick and raising the dead. So in among Muslims there is tremendous interest in Jesus as healer. I often say that there are really two kinds of Muslims who come to Christ. One, the kind that is attracted by his teaching, you know, as a way of life, and they often have huge difficulties about Christian doctrine, about the person of Christ, for instance, because they are attracted actually by his teaching. But then the other kind are those who have some sort of supernatural experience of Christ, a vision, a dream, a healing, very often these, all of them together, and they tend to have a sort of childlike trust in Jesus, and so don't have any doctrinal problems with believing what Christians believe. But certainly, I mean, in a country like Iran, a very large number of people have some experience of Jesus Christ in this way without any mediation by the Christian church at all.